So again, thank you. Without further ado, Stuart Murray Williams, as I said, is the chair of the Anabaptist Network in the United Kingdom, and Stuart is the author of numerous books, including, if I may borrow this because mine is in my office, The Naked Anabaptist, which is the title of our presentation today. And where is Isaac? Isaac Landis, stand up. Turn around. what do you think?
He posed.
I didn't need a haircut. Maybe it was Brad.
Well, maybe it was Brad. I'm not sure, but I think it could have been one of our own on the cover here. So, Stuart, blessings and.
Thank you, Gay. Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a naturally quiet voice, so if you can't hear me at any point, just give me a wave and I'll try and project a bit further. So my mission this week is to try to discover who is on the back cover, on the front cover of the book. Whose back of the head is that? What I'd like to do this morning then is just to tell you something of the story of the background to The Naked Anabaptist. I can see several copies around, and I'm aware that many of you have been reading it, but what's the context out of which it's emerged? So if I can talk a little bit about that somewhat personally this morning in terms of the interest in Anabaptism that I've had and that many of my friends in Britain have had. And then we'll have breakfast. And then the seven core convictions that are the heart of the book you have on the table in front of you. And I thought we would spend the discussion time reflecting a bit on those. So I'll say more about that in just a moment. So just let me introduce myself a little bit further. I'm a British Anabaptist. And I have absolutely no Mennonite heritage. I have the wrong kind of name, and I have nothing in terms of a Mennonite family background, or in fact any connection with any of the historic denominations that have emerged out of Anabaptism. I stumbled across Anabaptism about 25 years ago, and it has been the major shaping influence in my life and ministry since then. And I come to thank you for the title, The Naked Anabaptist, because it emerged from Pennsylvania. And the story that the book tells at the very beginning is of a car journey that two friends of mine made with Gay and with Steve and with Blaine Detweiler as well. This was 2 years ago? 3 years ago?
2008.
2008, okay, a couple of years ago. Driving somewhere together, and the conversation was, why are you Brits interested in Anabaptism? Now, what is it about the Anabaptist tradition that in your context seems to make sense? And one of the Brits who was here, Noel Moles, a friend of mine for almost 30 years, said, oh, you mean the naked Anabaptist? Anabaptism without the Mennonite clothing, the Mennonite culture that you're familiar with. And initially that produced some laughter, but when Noel told us a story when he came back to Britain, we thought that would be a great title for a book. And it was actually a book that we'd been thinking of writing for a while. We needed, in the UK, a very simple, straightforward introduction to the Anabaptist tradition. A growing number of Christians from many different denominations are discovering Anabaptism or are looking for something which we think may be Anabaptism. And what we haven't had is any simple, straightforward introduction to Anabaptism written primarily for the British context, where there are very few Mennonites. There are very few people from any of the historic denominations that have emerged out of Anabaptism. So we thought, that's what we need, and this title would do really well in terms of grabbing attention. So that's where it came from. Then the publisher that we decided to work with for this, a publisher that we've used in a variety of situations already, had real problems. About a year ago, the parent company effectively went bust. And so everything was put on hold. And so The Naked Anabaptist hasn't actually been published in the UK yet. It won't be out there until next February. Herald Press decided that they wanted to publish it as well. And so it came out here almost a year ahead of the British publication. It was written for Britain. It wasn't written for you. I just need to say that and recognize that. And if you've read the book, you'll know that I do suggest in the very beginning that it might be useful for some people in North America as well. But that was very much a kind of afterthought. Maybe this will be helpful. And so the level of interest here has come as a real surprise to us. Why are Mennonites, Church of the Brethren, Brethren in Christ people reading this book and finding it resonating with them? Why are Christians in other traditions in North America discovering Anabaptism through this. And this is the first time I've been here since the publication, so I'm looking forward to a range of conversations to try to understand a bit more of that. So The Naked Anabaptist is an attempt to spell out in some detail the seven core convictions that you've got on the tables. And this is a set of statements, it's a mixture of what we believe and what we're committing ourselves to, that have developed over the last 15 years or so. The version that you have there is the second or third revision. We've had several goes at trying to put this together, and this is the one that seems to have stuck with us for a while. And what they are is an attempt to express the kind of essence of the Anabaptist tradition, to try to get down to the real core of what is it that makes something Anabaptist, and to express it in a way that makes sense in Britain in the 21st century. So it is a contextual piece of work. It's not saying this is what any Anabaptist in any context might come up with. This is what makes sense in our context. This is an attempt to apply Anabaptist values and principles and practices to 21st century post-Christendom Britain, and to try to distill the essence of a tradition that many of us are finding very exciting. So as I say, rather than going through these with you now, what I suggest is when we've had a bit of food, that we then do some discussion around this. I'd be very interested to know, what is it about these convictions that has resonated with you? And also, what hasn't? You know, are there things here that you think, no, well, maybe 5 out of 7 or 6 out of 7, but no, we don't think that bit really is authentic Anabaptism. Or perhaps there are things that you think are missing. Why haven't they included this? And we would very much like to have that conversation. This is intended to be an ongoing discussion. The core convictions that you have here are where we have currently got to. And we would anticipate at some point making a further revision. There is also nothing sacrosanct about 7. We might end up with 8 or 9, or reduced to 6. So this isn't meant to be anything definitive. It's simply the stage we've reached on the journey at the present. And so I look forward to a number of conversations over the next week to test out some of these convictions with those of you who've got a much longer and deeper experience of the tradition than I have. Let me just say a little bit more about the context, how I discovered Anabaptism, and why the Anabaptist tradition seems to make sense to a lot of my fellow British Christians. 25 years ago, I was an urban church planter. I was living in East London, in one of the poorest communities in Britain, and trying to find resources to help me address issues of poverty, of injustice, multi-faith community, issues of discipleship, and I began reading perhaps more widely than I had before. My own family roots are Plymouth Brethren. I don't know whether there are Plymouth Brethren anywhere near here. So a fairly strong evangelical upbringing, but within a tradition that had always been somewhat on the margins of the British church scene. And I had gradually discovered, I guess in my late teens, that there were actually other Christians in the world apart from Plymouth Brethren, which came as a bit of a surprise initially, but I began to realise that was true. I began to read more and more widely, and particularly looking for resources to grapple with some of the issues that I was facing as a church planter. And some of the books that I found most helpful, I discovered, were written by Mennonites. And I had no idea what a Mennonite was. I don't think I even heard the term at that point. And because I was finding the books interesting, I wanted to find out more about who wrote them, discover they were part of the Anabaptist tradition, and I'd vaguely heard of Anabaptists, but only very vaguely. And so spent a while then tracing the history back and discovered the 16th century movement, and the more I read, the more I thought, I'm one of those. Not by background, not by family, but actually, this is what I believe. This is who I am. And there were a number of things that I guess resonated with me. I would have described myself, I guess, in the 1980s as an instinctive but unreflective pacifist. I was committed to peace, but I wasn't quite sure why. And Anabaptism gave me a theological framework. I now understood why, as a follower of Jesus, it made sense to be committed to peace. I was already committed to what I would now call a multi-voiced approach to church. Now, that was partly, I think, my own Brethren background, which also tended in that direction. But I was very strongly committed to the priesthood of all believers and to the active participation of the whole community. And again, as I read some of the early Anabaptist material, I thought these people were doing it. In a context where in the state churches it was dominated by a preacher or by a pastor, actually, these were communities that empowered many voices, and I valued that. and looking for authentic community and for radical forms of discipleship in the context in East London, I found many stories within the Anabaptist tradition that resonated with me. And perhaps the most important thing for me in some ways was the Christocentrism of Anabaptism. Having been raised in a tradition that seemed to prioritize the epistles over the gospels, to discover a tradition where the life and teaching of Jesus was taken very seriously was both a tremendous encouragement and stimulus to me. And I guess also to do with my context, as a missionary in an urban, multicultural, multi-faith environment, I encountered the Anabaptists, particularly as I read the early 16th century sources, as a bunch of passionate missionaries who spent their time moving around Europe, sharing their faith, planting churches, baptizing people. And it raised to me this interesting question: is it possible to be passionately committed to evangelism and passionately committed to peace at the same time? Because my experience even then had been of people who tended to be committed to one or the other. And rightly or wrongly, it seemed to me that I discovered a tradition that held them together. Soon after discovering the Anabaptists through reading, I discovered some real flesh and blood Anabaptists. I met Alan and Eleanor Crider, who many of you, I guess, will know, long-term Mennonite missionaries in London. And Alan and Eleanor at that point were just beginning to gather together a small group, which met about every 6 to 8 weeks around food and then conversation. A group of maybe no more than a dozen of us who in different ways had encountered the Anabaptist tradition and were looking for opportunities to explore it together. And we began to feel that actually we were onto something that might be important for the future of the church in Britain. That as we moved into a post-Christendom world, a world where the church was increasingly going to be on the margins of society, on the margins of culture, here was a marginal missionary movement from nearly 500 years ago that might actually help us make sense of that and equip us for that. In 1994, I came to North America for the first time and had my first encounter of Mennonites here. And it was an interesting experience. I'm heading off this afternoon to Elizabethtown, and it was in Elizabethtown that I first really encountered Mennonites. I came for the 50th anniversary celebration of Harold Bender's Anabaptist Vision, and I was invited to present a paper on why British Christians are interested in the Anabaptist tradition. And I had with me my 15-year-old son, Neil, his first time in the States as well. He was very excited about coming, and I just thought I ought to do a little bit of preparation for him. And so I said to him, well, look, we're going to be visiting Mennonites. And Mennonites are not like the Americans you've seen in the movies. So just be careful what you say and do. So these Mennonites, they are peaceful people. They're not gun-toting Americans like you've seen in the Westerns. And these are simple people. They live simply. They don't have a lot of resources. So just be aware of where you're coming. And we were met at the airport. I think we flew into JFK, and we were taken to our host. And it was quite late at night, and it was dark, and we couldn't see a huge amount, but we found ourselves being driven up this huge, long drive to a massive house. And we were met at the door by an elderly Mennonite with a shotgun. And it was just one of those images that will live forever in my mind, which I won't forget that evening. And he explained to us that he'd been scaring geese off his property. It's fine. But my son didn't believe a word I said about Mennonites. So there was a kind of shock there. But I guess the other surprise that trip and subsequent trips has brought to me is to find that actually there isn't always congruence between the Anabaptist vision, the Anabaptist tradition, and contemporary Mennonite life. And of course that's true of all traditions. As traditions age and grow and develop, things change from the kind of original core of it. I guess in particular I was surprised that Mennonites didn't seem to be as missional as their Anabaptist forebears. There didn't seem to be the same missional passion that I detected in the 16th century. And in particular, there seemed to be a reluctance to share verbal witness. The impression I got was that Mennonites believed that as long as you live good lives, as long as you live out the gospel, that will be a witness. Whereas it seems to me, certainly in our post-Christendom context, that simply will not do, because people have no way of interpreting those lives. There needs to be an explanation of why we live this way. And so I struggle to understand how the passionate verbal witnessing of the early Anabaptists seemed to have become something really quite quiet and restrained, and almost a reluctance to talk about faith. Maybe that's something we can dialogue a bit about this morning. And I also struggled, I guess, with why Mennonites live where they live. Now, that's partly, I'm sure, my bias as an urban church planter. I've been involved in urban church planting for 30 years. And I just couldn't quite understand why the Anabaptist values that I had found resonating so strongly with me as an urban church planter didn't seem to be drawing Mennonites all over North America into poor urban communities. Like, where you live seemed to me to be strange in terms of the values. Now, I've deeply appreciated my many trips to North America. I've been here many times over the last 15 years. One of the things that I've most appreciated about contact with Mennonites such as yourselves is that it earths the tradition that has become important to us. We're in danger in the UK of a kind of ethereal, idealized Anabaptism. When you haven't actually got any Anabaptist communities, it's so easy to talk about Anabaptist ideals. When you've got living communities, you've actually got to work it out in practice with the nitty-gritty stuff. And it's really been important for us to keep the connection, develop the connection with Mennonite communities that over the years have been trying to work this stuff out in practice. Sometimes succeeding, sometimes struggling. That's been really important for us. And I guess our hope is that in this ongoing conversation, we will continue to draw on that aspect, but also that something of the freshness of the Anabaptist tradition that we've discovered might be a resource to you. We hope this will be a two-way conversation that would be helpful to both of us. And so one of the things that I've been trying to do whenever I come across to the States is to say to Mennonite communities, Mennonite students, who seem to think sometimes that the Anabaptist tradition is just for historians, actually, this is a living tradition that many of us in other parts of the world are finding life-changing. And I've been, I suppose, struck by the lack of interest in many Mennonite circles in the Anabaptist tradition. My hope is that the book and the ongoing conversations might help to re-energize your own tradition as something life-giving and life-changing, rather than just something for dry historians. I suppose the other thing that has surprised me is what I was mentioning a moment or two ago, the lack of a missional dynamic in some of the Mennonite circles that I've been in. There's been a lot of talk about becoming a missional church, but what does it actually mean in practice? There's something about the missional ethos of the early Anabaptist tradition that has been really important for us. Most of those who are drawn to Anabaptism in the UK are committed to various forms of mission. It's been the mission dynamic of the Anabaptist tradition that's been most important to us. So I guess my reason for keep coming here, and I keep getting invited, which is great, but the reason I keep coming is partly to continue to draw on the resources of the Mennonite tradition, the sort of practical outworkings of that that go on generation by generation. And it's partly also as a way of saying thank you for a tradition that has been life-shaping for me, to offer back to you something of the things that we've found. And I think it's in particular the dynamism of the early Anabaptist tradition and the missional thrust and the question of, well, where do Mennonites most need to be in today's world? And if the experience of post-Christendom that has been ours for some time now in Britain, if that is where you are headed here in the States, then our hope is that our experience might be of some use to you. Gay has passed around another set of notes since I've started talking, which is an attempt to spell out what I mean by this word post-Christendom I've used a number of times. That is simply a description of where we are in Britain. It would relate also to many other parts of Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, Canada. I always have the conversation here in the States, is this post-Christendom here as well? And I get a variety of responses. Sometimes people say, yep, that's where we are. Others, no, nowhere near. And others, well, we're journeying in that direction. This is perhaps 25 years ahead for us, but this is where we're going. And if that's right, if post-Christendom is a way of describing your future, our hope is that the Anabaptist tradition that we have found as a resource for our post-Christendom might actually be a renewed resource for yours as well. So I hope that's helpful just as a kind of background to why we wrote the book, why the Anabaptist tradition seems to resonate with us. It's been fascinating getting a whole range of responses to the book already. As I said, it wasn't written for this context, but it's been interesting getting emails from quite a lot of people, including long-term Mennonites who have found it helpful, those who dropped out of Mennonite churches as perhaps young adults, who are seeing this as actually what I do believe in still, and others from completely outside of any of the historic traditions who have said, that makes sense to me. I need to find a way of connecting with this tradition. So it's been a very interesting discovery for us. A book that wasn't written really for this context is seemingly resonating here. I hope that's enough in terms of an introduction. What I suggest then after breakfast is that we have an opportunity to explore some of those things, either to respond to what I've said, or to engage particularly on these core convictions. And I really would like that to be as much of a dialogue around the room as possible. We don't present these to you as this is what Anabaptism is all about. We wouldn't dare to do that. You know it better than we do. But this is what it means for us in our context. This is how we've tried to apply and reinterpret it. And we would value your help to discern how much this has been authentic, particularly the areas that we might have either missed out completely that we should have there or have misinterpreted. So this is a working document. The trouble is when you put something in book form, it gives it a kind of solidity, and that worries us a little bit. But we can always do another one. But the really naked Anabaptist, or increasingly naked Anabaptist, or whatever. But we want the conversation to be ongoing. Thank you. Is that okay, Gay? Have I spoken for long enough for the food to be arriving?
The food is here. Yes. Ah. Steve, where are you? Okay. Would you like to tell us what we're going to do for our blessing?
Okay, we're doing some negotiating here very quickly. Because we are gathered in a small space and there are many of us, it feels appropriate to offer a blessing and song. I don't care, whichever one you might like, Emily. Emily just found, I just cued her on this a second ago. So
the only one I can think of is this little two-year-old one that I sing with my nephew, so I'm a little at a loss. Does anybody have an idea?
God is great and God is good.
Does everybody know that one?
Maybe if we can just, Emily, if you're able to, or Gay, if you can line it out
first,
just say it so that people can hear the words and then.
God is great and God is good, and we thank him for our food. By his hands we all are fed. Give us, Lord, our daily bread. It's to the tune of the doxology.
Okay. I think I got like that.
God is great and God is good, and we thank him for our food. By his hands we all are fed. Give us, Lord, our daily bread. Give us, Lord, our daily bread.
Thank you for the multivocal and shared communal leaning. Gay is going to give us a little bit of guidance on how to get our food. And those of you who are in chairs, I think there'll be a little bit more space out here in the sort of.
There will be tables here, and also the boardroom is available for folks to gather for breakfast. So you can start at the end of the serving table nearest this wall, and use both sides of the table. And Carla is frantically putting out food. And so give us just 1 minute.
Not the breakfast.
Oh,
the morning, so.
She so says fine. Knowing Shy Mennonite.
Hey, it's good to see you. You hungry?
Yeah.
And Stuart, at this point, I will turn it back to you.
And I will turn it out to you. What would you like to talk about? Would it be helpful to hear any more about the context? Would it be helpful to begin to dialogue around the core convictions? Would any of you like to take up particularly some of the issues in the last chapter, which suggests there are some weaknesses within the Anabaptist tradition as well as some strengths? That was perhaps the chapter that I felt most unsure about in terms of the context here. Over to you.
Thank you.
We have, how long do we have, Gay?
Could you talk a bit more about being missional? And particularly challenge us to get beyond our cultural identity in that regard.
We have, in the UK, quite a bit of missional language, and I gather that's also something you've had here quite a bit. And I guess what I'm interested in is how you get beyond missional language to missional practice. It seems to be fairly easy to rebrand things using a different term. How do you actually change the dynamic of a situation? And the post-Christendom transitions that you've got on the sheets there, one of the transitions I talk about there is a shift from maintenance to mission. Now, again, that's a very easy slogan to throw around. So I think it actually needs to be earthed in something very practical. I'm rather tired of the conversations about missional church. I want to ask questions about how do we get there? How do we develop communities which see mission as the big picture and then maintenance as the things we need to do in order to continue with that mission? And I think you actually need to measure it in some way. One of the things that I find quite helpful as a measurement is money. And you know, maybe again, that's something I've learned from the Anabaptist tradition. Sharing the resources seems to me to be really quite important in the whole way the movement developed. Slight track, but it might interest you to know that the Church of England, when it put together its 39 articles of religion, named the Anabaptists specifically as something to avoid. Now, there probably were hardly any Anabaptists in England at that time. England kept the Anabaptists out pretty vigorously. But the 38th of the 39 articles says no good Anglican should do what the Anabaptists do. And it's actually to do with economics. It's to do with sharing resources. Because it seemed to the good Anglicans that this was undermining the sacredness of private property. Now, I just think that's important, that it wasn't anything doctrinal, it wasn't even the peace witness, it was the economics of the Anabaptists that was so threatening. And it just seems to me that money, when Jesus said, where your treasure is, there your heart will be. And so I sometimes say to congregations that are wanting to talk about being missional, well, show me your books. But where is your money being spent? Because where your treasure is, there your heart will be. It's not where your heart is, there your treasure will be. It's not that money follows it, it's money demonstrates what you actually believe in. So it is to do with denominations, it's to do with congregations, and us as individuals, I think, demonstrating we're missional in practical ways. What do we spend our money on? Is it primarily our facilities, our pastors, our staffing, or is it primarily mission? Now, that's only one marker, but for me, unless you get down to some of those practicalities, you can talk missional language all the time. I guess the other thing, just to pick up what I was saying earlier, was this shift from mission as lifestyle to mission that is verbal. And you know, I've read enough of Mennonite history to know some of the reasons why the early Anabaptist verbal witness became much more of a kind of lifestyle witness. And you know, I want a 100% affirmed lifestyle witness. I mean, that is the foundation of everything else. But I think we're moving into a context, certainly in our situation, where you have to be verbal or else there is no witness. Because people don't know how to interpret even an authentic alternative way of living. So there's something about moving beyond missional intent to verbalizing what is it that we believe? Why do we live this way? And I think that's going to be an interesting journey for congregations and communities that have been so deeply rooted in mission as lifestyle that to take it other ways is going to be quite difficult. Particularly because you have here something we don't have in quite the same way in Britain. You have the evangelical right, you know, and very often there's plenty of verbal witness, but you just wish it wasn't. And you know, we don't have that kind of thing in the same way. We have a very tiny equivalent, but it's very marginal. It's regarded as stupid, and it's ignored. Now, that's very different from what I hear of what's going on here. So I think there's a particular dynamic here which is more difficult for you than for us, because as soon as you start talking about verbal witness, you begin to think, all the evangelical stuff. Mm-hmm. And I just think, well, actually, if you go deep enough, the Anabaptist tradition has its own verbal witness tradition, which is different.
I'm curious, you talk a lot about verbal witness and passion. I think you said passionate verbal witness. One of the core convictions, that's not one of them.
It's interesting, isn't it? You're quite right.
And why not?
I don't know.
Because it's not complete yet.
Because it's not complete, absolutely. In fact, it is interesting. That is one of the things that I'm wondering whether we do need to put in more explicitly in the next version of this. I haven't got a good answer to it. I think you're absolutely right. It's not there. I think it should be there. I guess it's to some extent that this there's something that emerged from a community. This is a community resource. I drafted the original document, but it went through all kinds of discussions and so on. And so this has emerged from a community where different people have emphasized different things. I'm interested that, you know, that didn't emerge. It's a good question. I will carry that back with me.
Could you talk about the connection of the number seven of your piece is at the heart of the gospel and witnessing for Christ. There's a tendency to be have an aversion to being forthright about the following Christ in the way of peace, and because of a fear that if we're too strong on that, then that's going to turn people off, yeah. So we can't really have a witness. So yeah. could you talk about that?
I've heard that several times. I simply have to say that doesn't seem to be the case in our context, where I think particularly since the invasion of Iraq, something has changed in our culture. There was such a strong reaction in the UK, in Europe generally, but in the UK in particular, to the invasion of Iraq, that the area of peace witness has been thrown open. There were people who were marching on the streets against the invasion of Iraq who had never been on a demonstration before. And quite a number of these were coordinated by churches. I was living in Oxford at the time, and the peace witness that we were involved in Oxford was led by an Anglican clergyman. So something shifted a few years ago in our culture, which has meant that whenever I talk about issues of peace now, I feel as if there's a completely open door. People want to hear this. Now, that may be very different here. But we have not found that talking about peace has in any way been an obstacle to the gospel. In fact, the opposite. It has been something which has given authenticity to the message. But that may be one of the contextual differences. Or it may be that you think it's an obstacle because it was once. Maybe in some situations it still is, but maybe in other places it's actually the peace witness that is going to be the connecting point for people to encounter the gospel. But I don't know your context well enough. Do you want to respond?
No, that's helpful to talk about the context. I think part of the situation that we find here in the States is that there's strong Christian movements that do not, they look down on the peace movements. There's also the statement that peace is presented as the way of following Christ, and maybe some people do that, but I think that's more not really the cause of this aversion to being forthright in peace. And it might be interesting to hear some others reflect on that, because it's our churches that are in that situation.
In Philadelphia, one of the witnesses that we have is going to gun shops and pressing them to stop supplying the illegal market. Wayne Nitsche was there on Good Friday when about 300 people, very diverse, had a Good Friday prayer service in front of the shooter shop on East Allegheny. And I must say, that kind of witness, public witness, in many ways is evangelism, because people are seeing the church take a stand against violence for peacemaking in a way that makes sense in our backyard. And it flies, and there were others there singing God Bless America and waving their flags. I mean, so choose your God. But I think the peace witness is vital. It has to touch on peace in our time, in our country.
I think the other thing that has been important for us, just responding to that, is the move away from peace as pacifism,
yes,
the kind of withdrawn in a negative sense to active peacemaking. And so we've tended to find that the language of shalom and then the practice of restorative justice or of issues of gun crime on the streets or ethnic reconciliation, those kinds of things are positive,
yes,
implementation of the peace vision rather than we don't go to war. Mm-hmm. That I think has been a shift which has made a significant difference. You first and then, yeah.
Okay. Going on, building off of that, and also your comment about moving from culture and mission, the whole maybe speaking about the maintenance to mission. In Christendom, the emphasis was on maintaining a supposedly, we could maybe say, Mennonite Christian status quo for our context. But in post-Christendom, it is on mission with contested environment. How have you, in your 15 years of visiting this land, have you seen how it could be contested, the culture?
I just think one of the things that we are going to need to learn is how to be a prophetic minority rather than a moral majority. The shift from being a moral majority to a prophetic minority, that actually within Europe and I think also within North America, there's been a sense of the church trying to be at the center of culture and trying to be the conscience of society and to tell society how it ought to live. I don't think that's the Anabaptist way, but I think it's the Christendom way. And I think the transition that we're going through is that actually whatever tradition you come from, whether it's a majority tradition or a minority tradition, in post-Christendom we're all going to be on the margins. We're all going to be minorities in a contested environment, in a plural society. And so learning how to engage authentically, faithfully, courageously, but also with the right kind of tone of voice in a contested environment is going to be really important. I think what irritates a post-Christendom society is a group that is now a minority continuing to speak as if it were a majority. And it just feels hollow and it feels inauthentic. So there's something about tone of voice which I think is really important. It's not that we withdraw, it's that we engage from a different perspective. We engage as those who tell a story that is not believed by most people or increasingly isn't even known by people. But we invite people to a different story, to a different set of values. But that's a very different model from the typical model of evangelism, which has been, well, you all know the story, so let's do this. We're in a context where people don't know the story. So we're starting from a lot further back. And it's a different tone, it's a different way of communicating.
More unbelieving, secular, etc. So my question to you is, who is listening to your message? That is, who are these people? Are they ex-Christians? Are they just totally secular people that have never heard the gospel at all? And how are you getting their attention?
Yeah. I would say at the moment that the work of the Anabaptist Network is mainly among Christians. What we, I think, have been trying to do is to resource Christians in a variety of traditions to rethink faith and discipleship in this changing environment. That's been the work of the Anabaptist Network. But I'm also involved with a group called Urban Expression, which is an urban church planting movement, which is planting churches in six different cities now across the UK. And those teams are primarily involved with people who have no faith, have never had faith. The areas we're working in are areas where people are probably three generations unchurched. So a long way back. I mean, post-Christendom has been a reality in some of these communities for 60 years. So the Anabaptist Network itself is primarily working in the Christian community, but within this network there are other groups. So the Urban Expression Church Planting, there's a political think tank which is engaging with those kinds of dimensions. There's a Peace and Justice campaigning group that's part of it. There's a range of different things under this umbrella. But I guess I'm particularly wearing the Anabaptist Network hat because I talk about these things, but it is broader than that. Nothing complicated. I mean, it seems to me as I travel around the churches that fundamentally what is attractive about the Christian faith is, and this will resonate with the Mennonite community, I'm sure, Christians living it. It is actually about kindness, gentleness, graciousness, accessibility, hospitality, all of those kinds of things. But I think the difference is it has also got to be interpreted. It's got to be explained. So I'm not in any way wanting to challenge the witness by lifestyle, which I so appreciate in the Mennonite community. But there is another step, which is about telling the story that has shaped these communities. And I think the thing that we're facing now is the context where people know absolutely nothing about the story. The language, the symbols, it is just unknown. Anybody under 40, I will no longer make any assumptions at all that they know anything. So you're starting in a very different place from where we used to. And so it's storytelling. Again, I think the narrative tradition is strong within the Anabaptist Mennonite community. It's the stories that have shaped the community and to become storytellers. So I don't think we need preaching evangelists in our context. We need great storytellers. Those who can tell and retell the story, partly telling the story of God, but also telling our own stories and telling stories of Christians at work today that live out some of these values. I think that's actually what gets people's attention. And I've been collecting what I call post-Christendom anecdotes, stories that illustrate the reality of these statements that you've got on the papers. And they're all over the place, where people know absolutely nothing. But when they hear something of this unknown story, they sit up and take notice. Just one example. I'm always wary of these examples. I've told them so many times. I don't think you've heard this one before. We run a course called Crucible, which is a training course for urban church planters. And we had an Anglican vicar came to one of these, I think it was last year or the year before, and he said that he'd been dealing with somebody in his parish who was not churched at all, some sort of pastoral crisis he got drawn into. And as he listened to her story, it was a pretty broken family situation, he found himself telling her the story of the prodigal son. It just seemed to him to make sense to tell the story. And she had never heard the story before, but she really responded to it. She said, that's fantastic, that really is just like my situation. Who did you say told that story first? She said, Jesus. Ah, didn't tell any other stories. So you get, you know, the attention is there. And of course, he did tell a few other stories. So it's those sorts of conversations that I didn't think 30 years ago we'd been having. Either because people would have known the story, and therefore it didn't have the same kind of surprise value, or you just had the sense of people, well, we've heard all that stuff before. Why would I want to hear that again? So there's a freshness, there's an opportunity to get people's attention in very simple ways, by living authentically, by telling these stories that people don't know. We're just beginning within the Anabaptist network itself to get people coming to some of the events that we run, which are primarily for the church, but people who have no Christian contact whatsoever. Conference about 18 months ago that we ran, we were looking at the subject of new monasticism. Now you would have thought that's a pretty sort of in-house subject. Why would anybody who's not part of church want to come to that? But at the end of one of the sessions that I was teaching, I had a young man come up to me and said, I'm not a Christian, I'm an anarchist, but I really want to hear more about what you're talking about. And I thought, that's interesting, we're beginning to get the anarchist community connected. You know, I actually think Anabaptist and anarchist don't just sound the same, but they're actually similar as well. We have quite a strong anarchist community in the city of Bristol where I live. And a friend of mine has recently been engaging with them. And I think actually there's ways in which Anabaptists can reach parts of society that most of the mainstream churches can't. And I think the anarchist community is one that we need to focus on a bit more. Quite how you can have an anarchist set of values and sort of coherence, I don't know. It'd be interesting to see how that works out. Yeah, two yes.
I would like to hear you comment a little bit on how political responses in, as you may perceive it from the outside, we just came through an election.
Yeah.
And I've noticed in congregations that there's a tension sometimes when we have Republicans and Democrats, and how that plays out with regards to Christendom, and either the attempt to retain it, or to mourn its loss, or those kind of things.
Yeah, I'm just conscious that your political situation is so different from ours. So, as I said earlier, we don't have the same kind of evangelical right wing that you have here. I would say the majority of evangelicals in Britain would be left-leaning rather than right-leaning. So that gives a very different flavour to the whole situation. You know, there would be exceptions to that, but on the whole, they would either be sort of centrist or they'd be slightly left-leaning. So, yeah, the dynamic is quite different. I think the perception within most British churches is that there should be no split between politics and religion. So you know, within Christendom, of course, you don't have a split. It's all sort of together. And the temptation as we move into post-Christendom is to pull the two apart, to say these are separate spheres. And I think the Anabaptist tradition has sometimes gone that route. I don't think we're going to do that. I think actually we're going to instead look for new ways of engaging politically. A colleague of mine who is involved in this think tank I mentioned earlier wrote a book a few years ago called Faith and Politics After Christendom, which was trying to engage with particularly these areas, and was arguing very strongly, it's not about withdrawal, it's about a new way of doing politics. And he starts his book with a quotation from one of our great parliamentarians, Tony Benn, who retired a few years ago, and he said the reason he was retiring from the House of Commons was to give more time to politics. What he meant by that was actually what really happens is grassroots politics. So much of the kind of show that you get in so-called government actually doesn't make as much difference as the grassroots stuff. Now again, I think there's something about an Anabaptist tradition that operates more comfortably from the grassroots than from places of power. And I think one of the things we need to work on is how we engage in the political arena in different ways, in a more powerless way, in a more provocative from the margin sort of way. I think those are some of the issues that we're going to be grappling with.
Is there some kind of way that we end up in our engagement actually recreating a new Christendom?
I think there's a real danger of that, and I certainly sense that in many places there is a desire for that. I find that particularly in some of the younger and larger churches. So when I talk about some of these things in those contexts, I get two reactions. First of all, people say, well, we weren't ever part of that Christendom. You know, we're only 20 years old as a network of churches, and maybe God's raising us up. You know, with the Christendom's dying, but God's raising us up as the new thing. And the second response I get is, well, Christendom wasn't a bad thing anyway. It's just we didn't do it very well. Let's do it better this time. And I think, no, surely we've learned some lessons from history. So I think there is that. I'm not suggesting everything in Christendom was bad. I think there is a right form of grieving for what we've lost. And there are gains and losses, I think. So one of the things that I work with churches on is how can you grieve Christendom? And I suspect that's going to be a reality for some of your congregations as well, whatever you call Christendom in the States, to actually grieve a sense of loss that's there. But I think I want to see that as a transitional phase, so that once you've been through that grieving process, we can throw some post-Christendom parties. We can celebrate the arrival of post-Christendom. And so that summary of post-Christendom that I've given you, if it isn't clear already, let me make it very clear. I am enthusiastic for post-Christendom. I want to see the end of imperial Christianity, whatever shape it takes. It's taken a very different shape in North America than it has in Europe. I just think it's great to deconnect the relationship between Christianity and power and wealth and status and coercion. I want rid of all that lot, because I think authentic Christianity has a chance of re-emerging. But I think the ways in which we've done things for centuries are going to take a while to unpick. It's going to be a difficult era. And I do wonder whether actually we need to change some of the language we use. I think I said somewhere in the book, I'm beginning to feel increasingly we may have to stop using the word Christian, because it's so loaded in our context. It means all the wrong things to many people. And many of our urban expression teams are already moving away from that. They're beginning instead to talk about themselves as followers of Jesus, which I think is perfectly authentic. And it's not in any way downplaying. In fact, it's a way of saying, particularly in majority Muslim communities, these are people who take their faith seriously. Christian simply means, well, Western. Whereas follower of Jesus means someone who takes seriously what it means to be a follower. So I think there's all sorts of language issues as well, which might help us.
When I read your book, I imagined you speaking to small, little, organic communities.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what that means for older churches, churches over 100,
yep.
Churches that have some institutional forms.
Yeah, I'm wondering that too. you're quite right. The until really the last 2 or 3 years, the Anabaptist network has been a network of individuals scattered across the different denominations. We have, as a network, not tried to establish new communities. We have been a resource to Christians wherever they are. Urban Expression has been planting new churches, but that's been somewhat different. What we've seen over the last 2 or 3 years is the beginnings of an emergence of Anabaptist communities, but most of them are pretty small. They're small, they're fragile, partly because they're new, and partly because of who they are, the kind of communities they are. But we do have some more established churches beginning to connect with us. So there's a church up in Leeds, in the north of England, that's
160 years old, would have about 100 members, something of that sort. And it's actually one of the leaders within that church who now coordinates our network of communities. So we are working out with them, what does this actually mean for you? And it's to some extent to do with how you make the transition from a few leaders who've caught the vision to the whole community. It's a transitioning process. We're at the very early beginnings of that. So I hear the question you're asking. I don't yet know how that's going to take shape. It's people catching a vision. I think part of it's storytelling. People beginning to hear stories that help them to understand what differences makes. But we're at the very beginnings of that sort of second phase. Up to now, it's been large individuals. We're now beginning to get communities and organizations that are identifying happily with the Anabaptist tradition. That's quite new for us.
I'm interested in the content of the verbal witness. We have a lot of language that is similar to the evangelicals on the right. Then we go to, say, the gun shop that you referred to, and we're identifying with pacifists and many others. And what is the content of that verbal message? Would it be reflected in some way in the core convictions itself, or what are we saying?
That's a good question, and it's one that I think many of us are reflecting on. What is the good news? I mean, what is news? What is good about that news? I think one area we've worked with quite a bit is the issue of guilt. That Christendom, I think, was largely a guilt culture. It was a culture where most people felt guilty and recognized that holy God, sinful human beings, there is an issue of guilt to be dealt with. And so the traditional evangelical approach to the gospel has been good news about guilt. You can be forgiven. You can be free of guilt and judgment and that sort of thing. I just don't think in a post-Christian world that's going to be the connective dot, which isn't making any kind of statement about whether we are guilty or not. It's simply saying that's not the presenting issue. That's not what people are feeling. I think we're moving into a post-guilt society. So the question then is, well, is the gospel big enough to connect with other issues? What about the issue of shame, which some people are suggesting is much more now the presenting issue in some Western cultures? What about the issue of fear? What about the issue of alienation, of loneliness? I think it's really asking the question, to what is the gospel good news? What are the connecting points? And we're beginning to feel that the language of guilt is not the best starting point, but some of these others might be helpful. The difficulty when you begin to have that conversation is that some congregations get very frightened. Somehow you're watering down the gospel. And we've had some pretty big debates, pretty nasty debates in the evangelical world in the last 5 or 6 years, where some of us have been asking those sorts of questions, and there's been an enormous pushback. It feels as if somehow you're losing something essential in the gospel. But I think we need to have the conversations. What we mustn't do is keep on giving answers to questions people aren't asking. What's the point of doing that? And I think that's where we would start. So we haven't got a kind of brand new, seven-point gospel that we can give out to people, because I don't think it's like that. I think it's much more to do with reading our context, including very local contexts. What are the issues locally to which the gospel might bring good news? And so it's moving away from formulae. It's moving away from prepackaged gospels to much more of a listening, much more of a conversational engagement. And I think also it is to do with conversation rather than just proclamation. It seems to me that we move out of an era where preaching the gospel in a sort of one-way approach is helpful into much more dialogue, much more conversational, a lot more listening than we've been used to. And I think for me, where the Anabaptist tradition has been helpful is pointing me back to Jesus, asking the question, how did Jesus evangelize? What did Jesus say and do? And one of the things that I find quite striking is how often Jesus asked questions and how rarely he gave answers, whereas the traditional evangelical approach has been to give all the answers. What if you turn it round? And what if instead you tell stories, you ask questions? I mean, Jesus must have been so frustrating, because you ask him a question and he tells you a story, or he gives you another question to think about. I just think we've got to get beyond the giving answers to asking the right questions. Maybe that's what evangelism is for the next 25 years. Let's find a few good questions to ask. Let's tell a few good stories. It's going to feel far less impressive and far more sort of edgy, but I just wonder whether that's actually what we need to do.
How do you present yourselves in the midst of major theological traditions? You say we're neither Catholic or Protestant, or we agree with the major doctrines of the Christian tradition, but we have these add-on things, or don't you try?
Interesting, it's not a question that comes up very often. I don't quite know why that is. I'm just trying to think of any conversations I've had along those lines. Several of the mainline denominations in Britain are in serious trouble. They're declining fast, and the way in which they have been church over many centuries is not working. So I think there is a willingness to reimagine that wasn't there 30 years ago. And so by and large, the Anabaptist voice is welcomed into the conversation as an alternative way of thinking about things. It's been really noticeable to us over the last 5 or 6 years how often we've had an invitation from ecumenical conversations, please bring an Anabaptist voice into this. Please tell us what Anabaptists think about whatever the subject is. It just feels like suddenly the door's opened. And I don't think it's people wanting to become Anabaptist or to take on board everything that we stand for, but there's a perception that because of the post-Christendom environment that pretty well everybody now recognises, to hear from a tradition that was never really part of the whole Christendom setup might be helpful. So we haven't had to do much work in terms of defining ourselves. The evangelical parts of the church in Britain is a growing part of a declining institution. So overall the church is declining, but the evangelical constituency within that is growing. Now, as I say, it's a very different kind of evangelicalism than perhaps you experience here. And on the whole, evangelicals would tend to see Anabaptists as being on their very far left wing. So we're not seen quite as evangelicals, but probably just about, they want to keep us just about within the camp. Now, I don't know if that's helpful or not. We listen to what they're saying. We haven't either claimed to be this or that. So we've tried very much not to be identified with particular parts of the church. And because we're a network of people scattered across the denominations, we have a range of theologies, we have a range of ecclesiologies, we have a range of missiologies. You know, we're a diverse community. And because of that, people actually find us quite difficult to pigeonhole, to work out where we are. And we're actually quite happy with that. Yeah, we quite like to pose questions. So we find that the Anabaptist Network is a place where people can come together, work together, pray together, even if they're in churches that hate each other. And I think there's something quite creative about that as well. So, yeah, we haven't really positioned ourselves in particular.
This is a bit of a synthesis question, I guess, between the Naked Anabaptist work that you've done and the planting churches in the 21st century. I'm just curious if you could help us. I serve a 257-year-old church. I'm aware of lots of young people that you're talking about finding the essence of this Anabaptist vision boiled down in the Naked Anabaptist very attractive, and yet grafting them into established, old, large congregations is very difficult. What might help can you offer to us with the two works together that we might learn from that would help us to think about, is church planting a part of what is needed in our context, and would those need to look differently for these new Anabaptists, the hyphenated Anabaptists, to find this in a church expression?
Thank you. I think what's, you have a very long answer to that, but I'll try and keep it short because I realize time is nearly up. It seems to me if we're going to journey effectively through the post-Christendom shift that I'm talking about, and I use the language of post-Christendom not to describe something that's arrived, but as a transitional phase. If we're going to journey through that phase, I believe we're going to need to see church planting as one of the change levers in denominations. It's not that our existing congregations can't change, they will need to change. If they're going to grapple with post-Christendom, they will need to change the way they do things. But change in an established 260-year-old congregation is not easy. You know, you've done things like this for a while. And even if there's a will to change, there's a lot of stuff that it's going to take a generation to change. I think post-Christendom is moving too fast for that. And I think what we will need are experimental initiatives, so let's call it church planting, where those who are pioneering, those who have fresh ways of thinking, are freed up to do that. Not in opposition to what we already have, or in isolation from what we already have, but as opportunities for the wider denomination to learn what might be. It seems to me what church planting gives us is an opportunity to try out things that might not work. Because if you try out things that might not work in an established congregation, you can cause all sorts of damage. And if instead you can see church planting as laboratories of the Spirit, opportunities to experiment under the guidance of the Spirit, then as long as you keep the relationships there, it's possible for the more established churches to have a look at some of these new initiatives and say, well, we're not sure we like everything they're doing, but actually we could do that, we could do this bit. It can be a way of helping more established congregations move forward more confidently, maybe not as fast as the pioneers, but faster than they would do without the pioneers. So that's why I'm particularly interested in church planting. It's not just simply to have more of what we've got already. I think that's a waste. But actually it's a way of reimagining church without destroying everything that we value. So it's a kind of partnership thing. That's for me the hope that I have for what's happening in the UK. We have hundreds and hundreds of what people call emerging churches or fresh expressions of church or a variety of other phrases being used, most of which are fragile, most of which we won't know for another 10 years whether they're going to survive. But there's an outbreak of creativity, which I think is part of the response to post-Christendom, and churches across the country looking at these and saying, what can we learn from them? And already there's beginning to be quite a lot of symbiosis, which I find very helpful. That's why I'm so committed to church planting. And I think the Anabaptists in the 16th century were effectively a church planting movement. They were saying there are certain things about the state churches which are not good news for our culture. We need to find a different way of being church. The difference today is church planters don't tend to get persecuted in the same way. It's much less risky now than it was. But I've talked to many church planters, and they certainly feel that they are taking risks, and they need the support of the more established congregations as they do that. And so it's holding this together that I think is so important.
Thank you, Stuart, for your reflecting with us on your own personal journey, as well as the journey of the Anabaptist community in the UK. It's always a privilege to get to hear and to think together. What I want to do now is to take about 2 to 5 minutes to do something that's multivocal. Our tendency, as you're rustling your papers and recognizing that it's about 10 o'clock, is to get out of here and to get on with your day. What I want to invite you to do is to breathe and to be together quietly for a few minutes. To invite you to speak a word, a question, or a phrase that the Spirit, through our time together, might be provoking or providing or instigating within you. This is a nightmare for the podcast, but feel free to speak those words, phrases, or questions from where you're at.
Lord, give us courage.
Help us to be quick to listen and slow to speak.
we're here communally in your presence, Lord.
Give us the right questions.
Free us to be creative.
Help us to partner rather than compete.
Make us dissatisfied with our answers.
Help us be storytellers.
Lord, help us to hang on to the scriptures and to Jesus and his teachings, but not to the head knowledge of Christendoms, post-Christendoms, and the cultures.
Ignite our imaginations.
Thank you for a voice.
Jesus said, "But I have a greater witness than John, my teaching and my miracles."
Gracious God, let us ask you questions today as we're moving about our schedule. Let the words that we've heard from Stuart and from the brothers and sisters across the Atlantic continue to speak to us and to provoke us. God, as part of this historic community, let us be creative and vibrant leaders and followers. In the way of Jesus, we go into the world and we ask these things. Amen. Thank you for participating. It's a wonderful exhibition of multivocal Anabaptist worship. If you're really interested in hearing Stuart and being a Stuart groupie, he will be available at a number of places here over the next